I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour Extra Bits, our little gift for you podcast subscribers. This week, we're continuing our bumper edition because it's Emma and Nat's last time on the podcast. In this show, you'll hear from Sophie Walker, former leader of the Women's Equality Party turned author, and Emma and Nat are going to share their highlights from the show. So, a news story this week survey. 20,000 people in 27 countries were surveyed to ask them what they thought sort of things were acceptable at work. And it turns out that 28% of men thought stories and jokes of a sexual nature at work were acceptable. Emma, in your office, if people are sharing a little sexy, sexy story, do you think that's okay or not? I don't know why I did it in that
sexy
voice.
Sexy, sexy story.
I think I'm just giving it some colour.
It depends, doesn't it? Well, did we sort of mention earlier about intent? Like, because, yeah, I mean, as a me and my team, we have all sorts of chats about all sorts of things. I don't think they're inappropriate, but... Yeah, I need some more context in this story.
So a bit more context. The research was provided by Ipsos Mori and the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London. And it found that British men are more accepting of such behaviour than their counterparts in countries such as Australia, Canada and the US. And the study also found that more British men than women would be comfortable calling out a senior colleague for making a sexist comment, which is quite interesting for me because it kind of shows both ways, which is we're happy to have a bit of, in quotes, banter, but also if we think things go too far, we will put our hand up and say. Mm. Now, do we think we're actually, the most men are actually putting their hands up and saying, hang on, it's gone too far? Or are they just, in theory, happy to do so when a researcher asks them?
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. So do you say the right thing for the research because everyone has a moral conscience and knows what the line is? I think it might be the latter. What I would say is I hope that we can find our sense of humour again. And it goes back to intent, right? Because in a group of women, I know conversations about sex and...
Happen all the time.
And the banter amongst women where the intent is understood, it can get a bit feisty. I like a man with a six pack. And so...
I don't think we've mentioned that. I've love a good that. Body
no.
recently,
you know what? I'm all my years of doing this show.
I'm
just
saying that
back in there. I don't believe we even mentioned that ever before.
Partial to a tattoo. So, you know, we have these conversations. But if a man was in earshot and was offended and was genuinely offended, then yes, I guess I'm in the wrong. But, you know, sex is part of life, right?
Yeah, but hang on. This is why you need more context to these things, because if you are a young woman at work and a guy makes a joke about having sex with you or you having sex with somebody else, That's different. Not a joke, is it?
And so that's the line in the intent. Yeah. So this is that's exactly the point. It's a power dynamic. Yeah. And so if an older male in the workplace makes that joke, I would say even in front of younger male colleagues, there's potentially an awkwardness there because the worldview is potentially is different, and the joke and the context just will be different. You know, a carry-on joke is not going to go down well with a group of Gen Zs or younger millennials because mm-hmm. they don't really know what carry-on is. Mm-hmm. Whereas I definitely know that I chuckled at a carry-on joke because it's what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. Vice versa, if an older woman made that joke in front of a younger group of men, I think that they might also feel quite awkward, yeah. but not necessarily know that they were allowed to feel awkward because yeah. they're men. And so it always comes down to the intent and the dynamic. And that's why, going back to the question, one in four men believe it's acceptable to tell lewd jokes at work, might be in that group of men, if they were having banter, they yeah. think it's fine. In the same way that if I was with my girls and we were having banter, I think it's
fine. Yeah, because when I read this, one in four men, I was like, I don't feel like this is just a statistic to do with men, because I feel like one in four women would probably say it was okay as well.
You'll be interested to know they asked the women this as well, and it was 16%. So more kind of around one in six-ish.
One in six. Well, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's... that women over the last few years, particularly since the Me Too movement, have become much more aware of what we say and do at work. And men have as well. But for men, that has actually felt like a bit of taking away some of the fun of work. Mm-hmm. Whereas for women, it's just like, oh, well, there we go. We're not going to talk about our personal sex lives at work anymore, even though we probably all have done. We'd love to know what you think. Would you tell a sexy story or a little joke at work? Give us a call, 03444991000. You can tell us. Now we've got a caller, a very special caller. Mm. In the 4 years of this show, we have had one loyal and devoted fan who has been with us the
Mama
whole
Sexton.
Time. It's Wendy Sexton, no Emma's mum.
I'm so proud that she's calling in.
Hi,
hello, Mom.
Wendy.
Hello there. It's only taken me 4 years to plug up.
We're so delighted to have you.
You've been doing a great job, ladies, and I've really enjoyed my Saturday nights with my glass of red wine and my box of chocolates, and it's made my night. So I hope the format's not going to change too much, is it, with you in charge, Natalie? Not Natalie.
Harriet. It's me. I will try and keep it similar as it won't be quite as... won't have Emma's flair to it.
Don't worry, Harriet. I'm sure my mum will be giving regular feedback because I get regular feedback on the show, don't I, Mum? I'm going to give Harriet your number and then you can just give her the direct feedback now.
You can let me know what you think.
Yeah, we have to get back on WhatsApp.
Yes.
WhatsApp. That's what I do. At the end of the show, I always WhatsApp Emma and tell her what I liked or what I didn't like.
And that's why the show's been so good, Wendy, because we've had that level of feedback. That's what you need. Like, constructive criticism is very important.
Do you know what? She's not just good with feedback on the show. She's incredible for feedback on how to run my business as well, aren't you, Mum?
Yes, with no knowledge of what I'm talking about.
Mama Sexton, can I just ask, what's been your favourite conversation that we've had so far today?
Today, I think it was Laura, was it? Honestly, I was nearly in tears. It was so moving, honestly, and so young and coping with all of that. I just thought, that was quite an overpowering moment, that.
And would you jump on a plane and go to Jordan?
No, all those, and I just think, how on earth did they manage to just think, well, I'm just going to do that? Yeah. No, I couldn't do any of that, no. Certainly not at my age now.
Do you have a standout moment of Emma's from the last few years?
Oh, gosh, now you've put me on the spot.
It's Matt Goss, isn't it, Mum?
She usually warns me if there's anything coming up. I think she's been pretty good.
Matt Goss, you got a bit excited about because you'd seen him on Loose Women. You were quite excited about me interviewing him, weren't you?
Oh, yes, I was, but I've gone off him now.
What about Tim Vincent?
I mean, I think that's Emma's view on him as well, so...
Yeah. I think he's very hard work.
High maintenance.
High maintenance, that's it. He'd spend longer in front of the mirror than I would, yeah. But, yeah, he was too gloss.
I think my mum needs her own show.
Yeah, she does.
Celebrity feedback. Wendy Sexton.
Well, there's a space going, Wendy, so you can come have it.
I don't think so, but I will, Natalie, say to you, Natalie, I hope your job goes really well and good luck with it all.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Wendy, and thank you for supporting us over the last 4 years and loaning us your daughter every Saturday.
All right, I'm glad to have her back. all the best, Harriet.
Bye, Mum. Love you.
Bye,
Mama Sexton.
Oh, cuteness!
I'm so proud of her for calling in because she was actually, yeah, that's a big deal for her to call in. Well done, Wendy.
4 years.
Thank you for listening to Badass Women's Hour. You can hear us every Saturday on Talk Radio from 7 p.m. for a full 3 hours. Yes, 3 hours of opinion, debate, and general setting the world to rights. Now let's get back to our guest. And we're meeting a woman who really does run this world, the amazing Sophie Walker. Hello!
Hello. I'm still working on that.
Welcome back to Badass Women's Hour XL. We love having you here.
Oh, thank you. It's so nice to be here.
You have had a full-on week. I mean, I think the last time we had you in the studio, you were still leader of the Women's Equality Party.
I think I was.
So much has changed since then.
Yes.
Now part of running the Young Women's Trust. Mm-hmm. And this week, published author.
Yes.
<Ta-da>! Tell us first of all about the book, 5 Rules for Rebellion. What inspired it?
Well, I got very tired and a bit discouraged. So it was autumn 2018 and I'd been a campaigner for about 10 years. I started... when we were trying to get my daughter diagnosed with autism, and it was a really long, painful process. So I'd started that and then moved into Women's Equality Party. And the 4 years I was leading the Women's Equality Party, the world just went mad.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had the EU referendum, Trump was elected, fake news became a thing. We had mass murder attacks in Paris and Barcelona, Manchester, Christchurch, 10 years of austerity, 1 in 50 people using food banks. And I just got to the point where I was very tired and I was looking at this thinking, I don't think I can really make much of a difference here. And then when you add to that the fact that, like, being a public feminist, mm-hmm. you get a lot of abuse. So I was getting a lot of abuse. And then I was getting a lot of, you know, from people that I really wanted to work with, I was getting, you know, the infighting, the sort of, oh, you're never a good feminist, you're really bad feminist, you'll never be a decent... And it just all felt huge and I had to stop. I was also really conscious that as a sort of white middle-class woman fronting a feminist political party, it was really important, actually, for us to make space for different voices. And I felt like I got to the point where I thought the only way I can be effective activist here is to get out of the way for somebody else to do it and to have a rest. And so I sat on my couch with the curtains drawn for a few months, and I watched every single episode of The Good Wife.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, my God. I was like, what have I been doing? But my brain wouldn't let it go. So my brain was like, but how do you do this? How, like, my working title for this was How to Be an Activist and Not Go Mad. Mm. And the breakthrough for me was the point at which I realised, look, activism is not a series of pitched battles. It's a philosophy for life. And then I thought, OK, so maybe I can work out what would underpin that philosophy. And maybe if I reflect long enough, I might have learned a few things that I could offer. And I interviewed women all around the world. I interviewed activists doing extraordinary stuff all around the world. And I started to notice that there were common points that we all shared. The moments where we had to get through despair, where we had to really channel our anger, where we had to sort of understand that hope is a real asset. Mm-hmm. And I ended up with this, 5 Rules for Rebellion. I mean, it's funny to sort of say there are rules for rebelling, but I just think there's a lot of brilliant people out there and we've never needed brilliant new ideas more. And if this book can just support somebody who might be feeling a little bit outfaced, then I'll be happy.
So, the book aside for a moment, how did you come out of your... I guess, that moment of despair. Because a young woman has said it to me last week. She was like, I'm trying to do good and it just feels so heavy.
Yeah.
Because I'm doing good in a really small bit, but the world just feels so wrong and unfair. Yeah. And I just said to her, you're alive. Just start from the place of being alive.
Yeah.
And if you can wake up every day and maintain a sense of sanity, then you're winning at life at least. Just start there. So what was it for you?
For me, it was two things. One was that actually feeling despair is in itself wanting better.
Mm.
And I found this wonderful quote by George Eliot in Middlemarch, and she said, "That which we call our despair is often the painful eagerness of unfed hope."
Mm.
And I thought, okay, wow, that's... So actually, by looking... When you look really closely into what feels awful, it's also your way out of it, because you do want more. You haven't given up. And then the other... I mean, there was a whole load of stuff, but it was also for me the realisation that as activists, we are a sisterhood.
Mm.
And when I might be flat on the floor, there's somebody else who's absolutely killing it.
Mm.
And that we're all part of this amazing... movement, and that you have to step out sometimes and somebody else will take it for you, and then other times you step back in and somebody else will step out.
Mm.
And so in that realization, the curtains were closed for a little while.
Yeah,
you opened the curtains.
Ta-da!
Yeah, and so book, new job, what's life been like? What have you been up to?
Well, I started writing and I started hustling a little bit at the same time. I was like, okay, so there's a few things I want to work on here. How do I do the work that I want to do as a feminist in different ways? Because I've never, you know, I didn't go into politics because I thought I want to be a politician. I went into politics because I thought I want women's equality. How do I come at it? Where's the angle I come at it? One of the other things I really wanted to do coming out of WEP was to find a way to fund women to do politics, because it was really like we were always struggling for money. We were always, you know, as a party that represents the poorest people in the country, the people most affected by austerity, the people who retire into pension poverty, the people on the lowest paid jobs. You know, we were not a party of billionaires like you know, some other parties where there are more white men in them. And what WEP always did was to, and still does, was to provide support for childcare and for people on low income so that you could actually campaign. I thought, that's what I want to do big style.
Mm.
And I want to do it for particularly women of colour and disabled women and working class women, because who are community activists. Mm. And that was the other bit. I really felt like our systems don't work because they are created by a very small group of white, straight, middle upper class men, non-disabled, who sort of design for themselves and think anybody else is just different and or irrelevant. But actually, when you look at the division and the difficulty in our local communities, when you look at like the impact on local support services by the austerity and the cuts to the public sector, the people who are holding it together are women. It's the women who are keeping the food banks open, who are running the libraries, you know, in volunteer shifts. It's the women who are providing the childcare co-ops. And I thought, those are the people I want to get into politics. So so it's all come together. We've launched an organisation, a fund called Activate, which is specifically aiming to support women from minority backgrounds with community activist experience to get elected. So that's the other thing I'm doing. And then I also I spotted that there was a job going at the Young Women's Trust, and I thought, oh, that looks interesting as well.
Yeah.
And then it all happened together. This week I thought I might have a heart attack. But no, it's all good.
You sound like you've got your activist fire back. Yeah. Have you?
Totally. I've just spent the day in Birmingham launching the Young Women's Trust's Young Women's Manifesto and movement. And I tell you, we are in good hands. Oh, my goodness me. What a brilliant, brilliant room full of fantastic women that was. We've been working with young women for the last several months, and they've basically written a manifesto for the world they want to see. Our research was showing us that I think it's about 70% of young women between the ages of 18 and 24 have given up on politics. Mm. They've just lost confidence in politicians. And interestingly, around the same number now identify as feminists. which is just amazing. So we thought, right, well, you're obviously impatient. You obviously don't particularly have faith in the people who are elected. So why don't we just write a manifesto? And I have to say, like, I've been a campaigner for 10 years. There is nothing more exciting than being in a room full of young women who are just going, right, what do we want and how are we going to do it? And so, yeah, I'm absolutely buzzing. I've been doing that with all day with them, talking about power in a room full of young women who were thinking, well, I haven't got any power. And you say, OK, let's break it down. There's power over other people. Yeah. There's power within you. Mm-hmm. There's collaborative power of your networks. Mm-hmm. There's, and like, oh my goodness, it was whoosh, room full of Wonder Women.
Yeah. So there is something about agency, right? That when someone figures out their own sense of agency and what they can do from within, and then what they can do within a network, and given that it's our last show, I'm going to say this is a brilliant example of that. Once that spark is lit, what it can do, it is exciting.
Yeah.
And so I do want to get into the book, but what else have you got planned with the Young Women's Trust? Because for a long time, the conversation has been about sort of supporting women in low paid work.
Yes.
But I'm guessing you're going to have a broader conversation than that.
Well, one of the first things we did when I joined, actually, was to look at the strategy and to look at our mission statement. Mm-hmm. And whereas we had previously... So for those who don't know, the Young Women's Trust used to be the YWCA. Mm-hmm. So it's got a very long history of supporting young women who are living in or on the edge of poverty. And then it rebranded about 7 years ago as Young Women's Trust with a focus on young women and work. And what we've done since I arrived is we have stretched that out again to say really clearly we are a feminist organisation and we are working towards economic justice for young women. Because when you talk about work and women, a really important big part of that work is unpaid work. Mm. And that was behind our campaign that we launched on Wednesday this last week called Young Women Count, which was a calculator for young women to work out how much money the Treasury owes them for all the caring, cleaning, domestic labour, emotional labour that we, you know, that government banks every year to support economic choices for men. And we worked out using ONS data that every year young women's unpaid work is worth £140 billion to the UK economy. And that compares as against the financial services sector, which is £132 billion. So this big, you know, the sector that government talk about all the time as it's terribly important, it's what keeps it, actually young women's work is worth more. So what we really want to do is we're campaigning for economic justice. We are really want to demonstrate that choices are made in a context and the context is what we have got to really look at and rebuild, because young women are being told from such a young age that they're not as important, that they're not as talented, that their options should not be the same. And I think it's a really good time to be having this conversation now, because, you know, we're building Brexit for opportunities for all, right? But when you look at where the government is planning to invest, it's really traditional spending. Mm-hmm. It's HS2, high-speed rail. It's that bridge between Scotland and Northern Ireland. It's the big investment pot for science, technology. Now, that's all brilliant, but unless you have a really clear understanding of who is available to do that work and why, then the future for young women looks very much like the past, which is like not a chance at economic equality. Mm. So, yeah, that's what we're up to.
Do you think, because I did the, you can go onto the website and go through and work out how many hours of unpaid labour you're doing a week, which is great. Yeah. Although I did it and then I was like, I really don't do enough housework.
But good, I'm glad you came out feeling good about it.
I was like, I feel like other people do a lot more than I do. But one of the things that struck me when I was doing it is I was like, I bet if I sent this to some guys, they'd be like, oh, well, I do just as many, and I do just as many, and I do just as many. And that they don't actually see the disparity. And I wonder if how we start to really show that, can we even?
Well, I'm very much about demonstrating it. And that was the point of the calculator, youngwomencount.org, if anyone's interested.
Yeah, great. It's really fun.
Still running. And I think that You know, if you know men who are filling it in saying, I do equal amount, brilliant. Yeah. I mean, fantastic. That's wonderful. But we know, I mean, data shows, right, that men don't do this work, and to the same extent that women do. And we also did some research around that campaign. We are trialling peer research. So we're aiming to extend our knowledge of young women by training young women to be researchers in their own life. So we had a group of young women talking to other young women about the unpaid work they do, and you get a completely different conversation going in that environment. And what became very, very quickly clear was that not only did most young women say the unpaid work they were doing was stopping them from being able to access paid work, they were also saying that the men in their families were not expected to do this work. Mm-hmm. And a worrying number were actually started talking about economic abuse, so feeling bullied and intimidated into doing this work.
We are going to keep talking to the amazing Sophie Walker.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast.
Welcome back to Badass Women's Hour XL, where we are talking to Sophie Walker, activist, leader, all-round total badass. Sophie, you've got your new book out, Five Rules for Rebellion, and we were talking at the beginning about how it kind of came to be, which was this moment where you're like, actually, activism has ground me down, and I need to go away and rest and then come back again. And part of that is being inspired by other people doing brilliant things and learning from them. And I wanted to ask you about actually this concept of rest.
Yes.
And how getting to that point where you were like, I need to go and close my curtains and stay away from everyone. Coming back from that to where you are now, how do you do activism differently now because of that?
I understand that I'm part of many, many people doing this work, and there's comfort in that. I've also got to a point where I've understood that I'm good enough. And I think that, you know, even as somebody who intellectually, as a feminist, understood the messages that we are sent as women every day that tell us we're not good enough and that we have to recognise that this happens and fight against it. I mean, I hate talking about making women more confident, for example. I hate all that stuff. It really winds me up. I think women are confident. We're born confident, but we have it knocked out of us. We don't need you to teach us to be confident. We need you to get out of the way. But it was a shock, actually, realising how much of that I myself had actually internalised and had was berating myself for not being strong enough and able enough. And also, I think also looking at leadership models, it's very hard not to fall into very traditional male ideas of leadership, which is like there's one person going over the hill with thousands of people behind you and you're always right.
Yeah.
Like you have to be right. There's no space to be wrong or to say, I don't know, or to, you know, the minute you make a mistake, you're done. And so I think actually just spending a bit of time to rest and to hang out with my kids that I hadn't, you know, really hadn't seen anything like enough of as a politician. And that in itself was painful. And also, to talk to other women and listen to other women and find out the work that other women were doing and to feel like I wasn't. And I say that and it's odd because, like, you know, the Women's Equality Party, the work I've done with autism support groups that, you know, the mums, the carers that I'd always connected to and worked with. Like, I was never doing this on my own. But I think somehow I had got to a point where I did feel, because I was tired, I was looking very inward. And that makes you feel alone, even when you're really not. So it was a chance for me to realise I really wasn't alone. And also, I mean, and I talk about this in the book, that, like, it's really important to look after yourself, right? It's really important to sleep, to eat, but not to get sidetracked by ideas of wellness. And you know, the green juice is great and the yoga is great. You know, get yourselves a spiralizer. but a spiralizer is not the answer to structural inequality.
Yeah.
And you have to keep your eyes on the prize. And I think what the book helped me to do, and I hope really helps other people to do, is to get a sense of the fact that this is it's a philosophy for life. And there will be times when you you can step out and you can come back in, and it will nourish you, and it will, you know, just being part of that cycle will nourish you, but also it will allow you to be kinder to yourself because you don't feel like, you know, you're the one going over the hill on your own.
Yeah.
Do you, so what examples of women going over the hill together do you have and can you point to? Because I think that's the other thing, right? So the book is great, and we are going to come on to the book in a minute. But the models of leadership are the individual, solo, heroic person going over, yeah, the Joseph Campbell, that's it.
Yeah.
But you must have more examples of women that are saying, actually, it's going to be collaboratively and we're all going to go over and we all work together. And if it goes wrong, it goes wrong, and we discuss it together.
Well, yeah. And I have to say, you know, I think my experience was because I was doing politics, and politics really forces you very quickly. And, you know, I think the Women's Equality Party is doing a really good job of doing politics differently and looking at how, you know, as a small party, they can be nimble and they can look at influencing and working with other people, which, you know, should not be radical, but still is in politics. I think in activism, I mean, the history of activism is the history of women. I mean, activism is as old as patriarchy, and it's a natural reaction to it. You know, women have always had to communicate and collaborate to create systems that work for them, because they're constantly being squashed by systems that don't work for them. And you know, I spoke to so many amazing women, you know, from all around the world. I spoke to some names that you'll recognise. I spoke to Jack Monro, who tells, you know, a fantastic story of how she experienced, you know, really biting food poverty and managed to work her way through that. Who else? I spoke to Shiori Ito, who is the face of Japan's Me Too movement. You know, how do you protest sexual harassment and violence in a country where there literally isn't the words to talk about it? Because, you know, she was amazing. I spoke to Joy Onyeso, who is a peace builder in Nigeria. I spoke to the women from the International League for Peace and Freedom who are working together in Sarajevo. I spoke to the great and glorious Gloria Steinem, who was very kind about me making a complete idiot of myself in front of her. I guess I'll get, like, wake up in the morning and go,
did you,
oh,
what
God.
Did you do?
I can't actually remember because it was so bad. She was over here doing a book tour, she very generously gave me some space to come and meet her and talk to her. And at the time, I think I'd been leading the Women's Equality Party for about 8 months. I'd just been announced as the candidate for London Mayor. I was quite surprised about all of those things. And I sort of went to see Gloria, like, you know, sort of approaching the oracle. I've got questions written in biro on both of my arms. And I was just completely overwhelmed both by her and by the scale of what I was trying to do. And I just absolutely blew it. So, but I included it in the book because I think it's really important. You know, I made a complete ass of myself in front of one of my heroines, and she was very kindly, you know, gave me other opportunities to talk and to email. But I made a lot of my mistakes in public. I think that in many respects helps to gather people to you, because you're saying, look, I'm not infallible. In fact, I'm quite often a bit of an idiot. But I'm learning, because I think, you know, it's really hard to be an activist, right? Campaigning is mostly losing. Yep. In order to get an idea that works, you have to take it out there and show it to other people. And that's really hard. I've seen so many good ideas fall apart because the person that had it couldn't share it and didn't want to hear feedback on it. And that's even harder when, in this world of social media, we are encouraged to be gladiatorial and we are encouraged not to be collaborative, but to really try to tear each other down. And that, you know, collaborating with compassion is something I talk about in the book. You have to connect to people, and you also have to understand that while you may be doing your campaigning from a sense of deep hurt and past vulnerability, that is often what drives people. It's not personal when people respond differently and have different ideas.
How much has Twitter in particular
impacted on your drive for activism? Because obviously recently in the media there's been lots coming up about Twitter and about that sort of bullying and backlash. And, you know, I've seen some of the abuse that you get on Twitter. You know, and much as social media can kind of be brilliant for activism, right? At the same time, if you are constantly pushing a narrative that not everybody perhaps agrees with or even sees, how much has Twitter played a part in actually, you know, putting you on the sofa for a while and shutting the guns?
Oh, I mean, played a big part in it. I mean, there were regular Twitter storms, and they would be choreographed pylons by people who I'm not going to name, but who would quite routinely look at my tweets and see what they could retweet with a sort of rude or sarcastic comment to get a bit of a, you know, just to get a story really about aggro, about nothing. I've learned how to deal with whataboutersers. I've learned how to spot people who engage in good faith and who engage in bad faith, and where to direct my energies. I do think that you can connect and have good experiences on social media. I've got much, much stricter about just muting or blocking or not responding to people who are not there with good energy. And getting offline as much as possible. Just get offline, see people face to face. It is so, so essential that we regroup and that we spend time with people who think differently to us, and find and educate each other and learn from each other and find spaces of mutual understanding. And that is simply not possible on Twitter.
On Twitter, that's what I find. And it's, you know, especially with everything that's happened, you know, I forgot what a turbulent time we've been through when you sort of mentioned all those things, the Trump, the marches, the, you know, but just being able to have that space where we are all learning, right? Yeah, and exactly. I even look back at probably some of the stuff that we were talking about 4 years ago on the show. I don't think I'd have the same view on those now, but you're right, we have this space. Twitter's particularly bad, but I think it seeps out into the general domain where everything's got to be black and white and nobody wants to just have a conversation or stay in the grey or be open to things.
Well, I think we're actively encouraged not to. You know, social media across a range of apps and outlets actively encourages us to be as individual as possible. It wants to put us in boxes so that it can sell to us.
Right.
What do you like? Yeah. What do you not like? I'm going to put you in that box over there so I can now send a whole stream of adverts. Mm. I know exactly who you are. I know your likes and dislikes. And I want you to be really clear about your likes and dislikes because I, you know, I'm trying to make money out of you.
Yeah, and I'm going to keep feeding you the same likes and dislikes as well, right? Yeah. That's the other Trump.
Sophie,
the book is called 5 Rules for Rebellion, and the rules are, I'm going to read them, defeat despair, channel rage, wield hope as power, collaborate with compassion, and practice perseverance.
Yes.
Finally, of the 5, which one do you think is the most important?
I don't think you can separate them, and that was what I learned. Sorry, that's a cover. You get to do all of them all the time. I really am not trying to duck the question. I think at the time I was learning about each of those stages, they seemed like the most important. I think certainly understanding that hope is power was an absolute revelation to me. Like, we talk about hope as being something that's quite fluffy and a bit soft, you know, sort of skipping through the daffodils. Oh, it's all going to be, you know, with a bit of luck, it'll all be fine. Hope requires determination. It requires you to set your intention, as yoga fans would put it, every morning, that you are going to be hopeful. And hope is something that is the ultimate act of defiance. Mm. It is the thing that nobody can take away from you. And I found this wonderful quote in a book by Rebecca Solnit, and she says, hope is not a lottery ticket that you sit on the sofa and clutch feeling lucky. It is an axe that you break down doors with in an emergency. And I just, like, I'm going to have that tattooed on my so I think, yeah, there you are. You've got your answer. I've gone to hope. But I think they all work. One leads into the next, and it is a continuous circle.
Sophie, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. You are, as ever, a huge, huge inspiration. Thank you for all your work.
Oh, you're so welcome.
You're making Harriet cry.
She always makes me cry. Five Rules for Rebellion. Let's Change the World Ourselves by Sophie Walker. Out now. Go buy it.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
The Badass Women's Hour is Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass. And some incredible women, and a man. Occasionally, when we let them in the studio...
Yes, as we've mentioned throughout the show, this is the last Badass Women's Hour with all three of us. I will be here next week with some fabulous guest presenters. But Nat and Emma, our journey has come to an end, my darlings.
I feel half sad, half excited to get my Saturday nights back.
Well, here to ask us all about it and to extract your highlights from you, we couldn't have anyone else other than our showbiz editor, Johnny Seifert.
Good evening, ladies.
How are you, Johnny?
I'm very excited. I'm very excited.
How did that happen?
It's a journey we've all been on together.
Yeah,
I mean, right. let's for those who have kind of joined us on the journey, let's go for it systematically. So let's go back to the beginning. So Nat, you came up with this big idea when I was just a little boy, a little innocent boy who thought the world was all amazing and full of rainbows, and the right girl was out there for me, but we didn't know how to swim to find her.
Well, no. So let's roll back. Actually, International Women's Day. It would have been 2016,
probably just about. Yep.
You and Emma and H did an event at the W Hotels, and it went really well. And it had the word badass in it, right?
It was called Badass Mavericks.
That was it.
That was a good title.
And then the W were like, we want to do something. You emailed me and were like, the W want to do something. I can't be asked, but you might want to do it.
Well, no, you had your whole thing around the badass principles.
Yes, that's true.
Oh, you had a concept.
This is true. And so I chucked together a bit of a deck, because anyone that knows me knows that I love a deck. I love a PowerPoint deck. And said, well, let's just do a series. And you guys have already started it, so we'll just continue it. And we'll do a live broadcast in front of an audience. But because we always have to sweat the asset, which is another thing I say all the time, we're going to podcast it. And it means that more people can listen to it. And then we were like, well, it might as well be a radio show, because, you know, why wouldn't people want to listen to everything that we say? And we called up Virgin Radio to begin with. And they said, well, we don't really do talk, but speak to talk. And we came along and met a lovely man called Lauren. Well, we met a lovely man called Lauren and a lovely man called Denny and a lovely woman called Lauren. And they sort of said...
Yeah, go on then.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Well, 3 hours.
Well, what we found out was, actually, they were like, yeah, this sounds good. We'll do it as a podcast. And we had that podcast format. Yeah. And then they wanted to see if we'd keep showing up.
Yeah.
And we did. Every Friday, we produced the whole show. Yeah. We found all the guests. We showed up every Friday from September to December to get that show done.
I think they thought we were going to last, 4 weeks?
Yes. Yeah. They were like, they didn't think we'd last, did they?
And we kept on showing up. And we did. We produced it. So, Johnny, we produced our show.
How did I get the short straw that I have to book you 12 guests a week when you did it all yourselves?
But that's how, that's, and then we were like, we want to go live every week. And then we're like, hey, you can go live. And we went live for an hour.
No, we didn't. We went straight to a 3-hour live show 2 years ago.
3 hours?
Yeah. 2 years ago.
Did we?
Yeah.
God, I've written that bit out of my mind.
Yeah, we did.
It was a very long 3 hours.
When we were doing the podcast, Laurie, bless him, he said, always, let's do this like it's live. And what I noticed when I speak to other people who are doing podcasts, they're like, wow, it took me 4 hours to do that podcast. And I think right from the word go, we just acted like it was a live show. And I think that's, one, I think that's made me a better communicator. But then, because you've got no chance to really edit.
Yeah. And so that I think that I totally agree with that. Being able to say what you think in the moment and be okay if it's wrong, if it's not actually what you really mean, or actually it's not that smart, the confidence it's given me now, just be like, well,
yeah.
That's what I thought in the moment.
That's what I thought in the moment. It wasn't that smart, but it's okay. Nothing bad's happened. I've had another opinion now. I'll share that one instead. Exactly.
And I think we got very good at calling each other out when we weren't smart. I mean, I know I definitely got some countries mixed up a few times, didn't I? You know, and then you just like, you've got to acknowledge the mistake there and then because you can't edit it out. But then that makes for a much more kind of vulnerable conversation.
And it's also the excellent producers that you've had that have shaped you of who you are and moulded you. Because you've gone through how many producers in 2 years?
But you know what it is? I think we're not radio presenters, right? And I think what it was is we knew the show, we knew the concept, we knew the conversations, what we wanted to do. What we didn't realise is actually you producers, you drive these shows and the presenters are like the personality that deliver the content, but you're shaping that. And I think for us, we didn't know that and we didn't understand that. So we would really push back hard on the... So we probably got a reputation as being total divas, but we're not, are we, Johnny?
Well, I think what we've learned actually is that we had to challenge our own unconscious bias. So we had three women and then look, the one that stuck was a man.
Yeah. And look how much you hated that.
No, but I think it was good because I think you didn't... You just had a completely opposite lens to us. And you're also coming from a radio perspective and we were coming from a podcast. But I think you've been great, Johnny, because I feel like we've been able to be really honest with you and disagree with you, but you've never taken it personally. You've been coming from a place where you want to make a great radio show and we've been coming from the place where we want that too. And I think there's been a really good working relationship.
That's something not everyone realises as well, is that when, not that you had an agenda, but there's a mission, there's a statement that you wanted to try and make, and there's a and you leaders had an agenda that you wanted to do. You wanted to, you know, champion people that don't get heard. And it's very easy to say that, but when you're trying to do it on the mainstream or you've got someone who thinks about it from a completely different view, it's quite hard for someone from the other side to look into what you're doing. It's like any niche, like, you know, if you don't ever know what sewing is and then you're getting a sewing committee on, you know, you're having to learn. And for me, it's been amazing because when I took over producing this show 2 years ago and I thought...
It's been 2 years!
Well...
Yeah, probably.
It's 2 years in September, it'll be. Yeah. And I was like... Which it's is basically, it's not 2 years, it's 18 months, but whatever. And I was like, I don't understand the show because I saw the show based on one Instagram video, which was you talking about your pubic hair, which I'll never let you live down. And I thought, was that what you're talking about?
It was a very important conversation.
When I came in, and that I remember the first ever running order when I covered the show, and I was like, I don't get this show. And I remember I ripped up the running order and started it all again. And then over the next 6 months, we worked really hard trying to make it a thing. I think now it's something we should all be so proud of. And also, I get it. I get what you're doing, and I actually actively do what you're doing now.
I'm so proud of you,
because
Johnny.
I do see the problem. You know, like Chanel's put out this thing of their the first plus size model in 10 years, but doesn't look plus size whatsoever, and is a white woman. I'm like, no, that should be a minority, and also plus size is plus size, not just a little bit bigger. So
you've learned so much
and you've taught me about girls as well, which is weird,
and now you've got a girlfriend, so look how well this works.
We're exclusive, do not get her any ideas, we're exclusive. Mum, dad don't know, so please don't tell them.
We've only got 2 minutes, so let's have a little highlight, one highlight each of the last few years. Now What would yours be?
My highlight would be the dinner we had with Virgin, and I sat next to Monroe Bergdorf, and we had a conversation, black woman to black woman, about the challenges that trans black women face and my preconceptions of trans women and black trans women. And we had a really good heart-to-heart, and it will go down in history as one of my favourite times.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Mine was Rose McGowan, not because it was Rose McGowan. I think being able to interview a celebrity of that calibre was really interesting. But what it taught me was how wonderful that all the other conversations that we were having, because when we were talking to Rose, I felt she was very guarded, and it made me appreciate all the other guests that we have on the show who are not those sort of massive stars and not media trained, and the lovely raw, really feels like a really interesting, like non-media trained conversations. And I noticed that was a big realization for me.
For me, I have two. So I have our debut, our kind of Spice Girls, the early years debut at Box Park Croydon.
Oh, yes! I do.
We did an event at Box Park Croydon. Yeah. Everyone else was having dinner. We were on stage trying to talk about feminism. Nobody cared.
Our photography looked awesome on those big screens.
So good. And then also Carrie Gracie, who came in and talked so meaningfully about the gender pay gap. And what she really showed to me is that actually you can be one person and you can make a change for a difference for everyone. And I feel like sometimes we come in here on a Saturday night and it's just a radio show, and then we forget that actually we do one thing well and we make a change. So it has been a pleasure, my loves. Thank you very much.
Will you keep flying the badass flag, Harriet?
Be badass.
For the final time, I will be here again next week. But if you want to follow Emma and Nat in the meantime, you can find me at Harriet Minter, Emma
at Emma Sexton,
Natalie,
and for the last time at Nat D. Campbell.
So that's the end of this extra bit, but not the end of Badass Women's Hour. We'll be back next week. Well, I'll be back next week with some very special guest stars, and the conversation will continue online. You can find us at Badass Women's Hour, HR, or of course you can find me at Harriet Minter, Emma at Emma Sexton, and Nat at Nat D. Campbell.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.